Dopey Podcast. Dopey Podcast.
Well, Dopey now podcast. Is the time for the Dopey Podcast. Dopey Podcast. Where you call in and Dopey put podcast. All your life on blast. And you call Dopey in podcast. And talk about your past. Because your Dopey life was curious, hardcore and fast. So Dopey now podcast. Is the time for the Dopey Podcast.
Dopey Podcast.
It's the Dopey Podcast, the Dopey Podcast, yo. This is the Dopey Podcast. This is the Dopey Podcast. Now if your life was furious, hardcore and fast, you feel like you want to put your life on blast, just call up the show and I talk about your past. Cause now is the time for the Dopey Podcast.
Dopey Podcast.
It's the Dopey Podcast, the Dopey, Dopey Podcast, yo. This is the Dopey Podcast. This is the Dopey Podcast.
This bonus episode of Dopey is brought to you by our friends at Aloe Recovery, located in sunny Southern California, in Malibu and Silver Lake, and apparently another location in West Hollywood. Aloe was created by our friend Bob Forrest and his friends Evan, Jared, and Bob to create a place where addicts and alcoholics are treated with compassion and connection rather than control. They have decades and decades of experience treating co-occurring mental health disorders, including severe mental illness, as well as addiction in general. They have amenities that make addicts feel good, like sound bath meditation, the sweat lodge, equine therapy, and surfing. They approach healing with kindness, and I have friends who have been there who told me it was an amazing experience for them. So if you're fucked and you're willing to go to sunny Southern California, I totally recommend going to Aloe. And hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Dopey. I'm just pumping out bonus episodes because I like to. I have all this material sitting around. This was a Patreon episode that was meant to be a regular episode, but then it became a Patreon episode. But I liked the interview so much, I wanted to put it up on the regular feed. So this is a filmmaker, AJ Eaton. He made a documentary about one of my favorite musicians, David Crosby. His movie was called Remember My Name. And basically, support us on Patreon. Go join up on Patreon. There's tons of content. This is a sneak preview of some of the amazing content on Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/dopeypodcast. And I've always loved David Crosby to the max. I love his music. I love his singing. I love his arrogant style. And last summer, I saw this documentary called Remember My Name, and I reached out to AJ Eaton, and he agreed to come on. The funny thing is that for all of you old school dopeys out there, you know that years ago, Crosby himself blocked me on Twitter. And I think me and AJ Eaton go into it a bit. But the movie's amazing. I like this interview. Let me know what you think. Drop us a line at dopeypodcast@gmail.com. Sign up for the Patreon because it helps to put more Dopey in the universe. And sit back and relax and check out Mr. AJ Eaton. So I think this is very exciting. A couple weeks ago, I was looking at Amazon looking for something I hadn't watched, and I saw this documentary that I'd been reading about called David Crosby, Remember My Name, and I was blown out by it. And I just kind of randomly tweeted at the filmmaker, this guy named AJ Eaton, and he said he wanted to come on. So welcome to Dopey, AJ Eaton.
Hey, glad to be here.
I love this movie. I thought it was an amazing movie. And before we say anything else, you should know that fucking Crosby blocked me on Twitter years ago. And it was like a medal of honor for me, because I kept asking him if he thought that he was a worse crackhead than Rick James or Papa John Phillips, and I think he got annoyed.
Yeah, he probably didn't like that.
I don't think he knew where I was coming from, because I mean, I'm a lifelong
Crosby fan, and I'm also a lifelong rock and roll fan, and I love movies like this. Do you like the rock and roll documentary also, just in general?
Well, I like stories of music and musicians, because I grew up around musicians. My dad was a songwriter, and we had a recording studio at our house, actually, growing up. And there was an influx of musicians that my dad was working with, or, you know, recording at the studio or whatever. And I just, each one of these people that would walk into this, or, you know, that my dad was touring with, he, you know, again, he was a songwriter. They all had these just fascinating stories, and some people who should have made it didn't, and some people who, you know, you surprised would make it. You know, it's just, it's a fascinating array of stories what you're dealing with musicians.
Totally. And I think that Crosby is one of the more, like, if you watch rock and roll documentaries, if you watch TV about rock and roll, if you watch films about rock and roll, you see Crosby pop up everywhere, but never anything like the movie you made. Which I think was just, that's why it blew everybody's mind, I think, because it was so honest. I know that your brother was playing with Crosby. Is that what got you towards him?
Yeah, my brother is this really talented guy named Marcus Eaton, and he's got this, he is especially gifted on the guitar. He's not here, so I can say that without his ego getting too blown out of proportion. But
I'm sure he listens to Dopey constantly, though. So, Marcus, I know when you're listening, don't blush or anything.
Yeah, so he's got, Marcus is like really just, you know, very talented at guitar, and was introduced to Crosby, and he just hit it off. And that introduction was just so surprising, and that was kind of the beginning of what was a surprising array of introduction. So Marcus, my brother, said, you know, invited me to come over and check out what they were recording on, they were writing some songs, which were for Crosby's first solo album in 20 years, which was called Cros.
Right, with his son, his estranged son, right?
Yeah, James Raymond, yep.
Right.
And James and Cros had a band called CPR, which is this album that a lot of people just don't know about, but it is on, you know, it's on Spotify and Apple Music. CPR, it stands for Crosby, Pavar, and Raymond, and it's absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous music. And so, you know, when I was meeting Cros and seeing this story between he and his son James, then I went back and started listening to this music that they'd made on CPR, and I was just shocked. It was so good. And so
as a storyteller, were you first drawn to that story, the Crosby Raymond father son thing? Was that the beginning of your interest or no?
Yes, I was. I saw what Crosby and his son were up to, and I was just, again, like, just blown away by the fact that these people were making up for all of this lost time together, having not, you know, he didn't really know each other until James was like 30, or that's when, you know, he met Cros. And and being a son of a songwriter, and being, I just thought that was a really beautiful thing. And and also just what they were up to in the recording studio with my brother, and the music was just luscious. It was you know, real fresh, and Crosby was just full of all these new ideas, and he wasn't afraid to try new things, you know, and that was what really struck me. So I said in passing to Crosby, after we all became friends, that, you know, I should bring my camera crew in and just shoot some footage just for posterity, perhaps. And he was agreeable to that. And my hunch was that, you know, once I started rolling film, then he would perhaps start talking about some, you know, some experiences, and that was right. He was ready to start talking, and we turned some footage into some, you know, like little EPKs about the recording of his albums, because he's recorded four albums in 5 years. He's halfway through a fifth. And but what I was really surprised about, which kind of goes to what you talk about, which is that, you know, I had known you know, I was aware of Crosby's music. I was aware of, like, you know, CSN and the Our Houses and the Southern Cross and, you know, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes and all that. I mean, you can't not grow up in the 80s and 90s and not be aware of those songs just because they're on the radio. They're, you know, playing in restaurants when you're sitting there eating. And so, you know, but I also knew because you can't, growing up in the 80s and 90s, you hear the headlines about Crosby, you know, being an addict. And, you know, there was a People magazine cover where it was like, you know, Confessions of an Addict. And right. I knew that that was a sensitive topic, but I was also so surprised at how just lucid his mind and imagination was at this point in time. Because, you know, I know some people who were recovering addicts and hadn't gone down to the depths that Crosby had gone. And they never kind of came fully back, you know, even if they're clean and sober, you can tell it kind of damaged their cognitive abilities, I think, a little bit. And not Crosby. I mean, he was just full in all of his faculties with it. He's pokes fun. He's got a great memory. And that's why, you know, when I met Cameron and I both realized, like, Crosby's ready to talk and now's the time to get him to talk.
Right.
And so that was kind of the way that the journey began.
It's just unbelievable because I was just reading I had seen the movie a few weeks ago and I was going to watch it again on Amazon, but it's not rentable on Amazon anymore. Now you have to subscribe to Stars if you want to watch it or you have to buy it. I should have bought it. Forgive me for not buying it. We were about to do this. I was like, am I going to buy it? But so I started reading the story, and as you're trying to make the documentary, when Cameron Crowe comes into the story, it's just so cool because he got his start interviewing Crosby back then, and he was just the ideal person for you to meet, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's funny because, you know, these Hollywood tales about how movies come together, and, you know, I had been, you know, I'm also a screenwriter and, you know, director and narrative, and I've got other projects, you know, in various stages of development and all of that. And so, you know, these things can be surprising and they can take time. But when I met Cameron, through our executive producer, Jill Mazursky, I had just kind of like said, look, you know, I'm thinking about doing this Crosby movie. And he just almost fell off his chair. Just go, whoa, that's so, you're doing a Crosby movie. He agreed. You know, I've interviewed him since I was, you know, since I was 16.
Right.
And I showed him some footage and of what we'd already shot. And, he was like, let me do the next interview for you. And so then again, that was like him saying, I can see Crosby's ready to talk. And they've had this legacy, as you see in the movie, of Crosby just being completely truthful and blunt. And which was remarkable for him to give these great omissions and great honesty to a young, you know, 16-year-old journalist at that time and just be completely frank. And I think that Crosby is, in a way, that's kind of a really commendable thing for him as a musician at his level and to be as truthful and blunt. I mean, you know, follow him on Twitter. Sorry, he blocked you.
You gotta get him to unblock me, first of all. And secondly, the thing about Crosby is not only was he in The Byrds, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, obviously Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, and had his solo run, and he's just this prolific singer, songwriter, harmony singer. He's also like, so he's a rock and roll star of the first order. He's also a drug addict of the first order. When you read about the stuff he did, where he wound up, the substances he used and the amounts he used and what happened. So again, when you talk about him coming back and his faculties being intact, it's a big deal. I get that. Another thing, the movie shot incredibly beautifully. It just feels good to see. But the thing about Crosby is he's so blustery. That's why I didn't think he'd block me on Twitter. I figured he'd enjoy my bluster. But he's so blustery that he wanted to knock Cameron Crowe out when he was 15 with craziness. And when he would go on the Mike Douglas show, he wanted to be like profoundly loudmouthy. Like that was a thing of his, right? He enjoyed being that guy.
Yeah, I think that there's, like, you see him go up on stage and talk about the Kennedy assassination, right, when he was with the Byrds. And you can see that he, in a way, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, he feels like his job is to be the blunt, you know, town crier, you know, if you will, the spokesperson of our generation. But also, that's a way for him to attract attention, too.
Right.
Can you believe what Crosby just said?
Right.
But most of the time, what he says is usually pretty commendable as far as, like, it's defending democracy, or it's, you know, calling to people to reconsider something, you know, usually, you know. And that's what got you into, like, Ohio, you know, when he shows Neil Young that cover of Time magazine and says, geez, this is just terrible, and then inspires a song, one of the great protest songs, to be written right there and there.
Well, that was another thing in the movie that just, I think it was probably the most mind-blowing thing, was how candidly he talked about his friendships with mostly Nash and Young, and how, mm-hmm, they totally went south on him, and how he wasn't a good friend. And you think this band, and you kind of have an idea that this band was close, just the way they sing harmonies, just the way they came together, just the way they presented. You know, if you watch them, and to know that they're not speaking now, and he says, I was a dick, it's so vulnerable, and it's so sad as a fan, mm-hmm, to not see them together. What was that like for you, uncovering that information?
Well, it's, you know, watching the movie is heartbreaking if you're just a person not knowing who Crosby is, and you see this guy who has had this career, and the career was largely based on him harmonizing in every sense of the word,
right,
with all of these other equally talented people. And they changed, you know, they forever changed the course of rock music, if you will, or music. And you see these photos of these guys playing 80,000 people stadiums with just four guys standing in front of a mic. There's no pyrotechnics, there's no dancers, you know, like, that's true musicians there. And so, you know, it's sad to have that be told to you, that, like, we're no longer friends and we're no longer making music. But then, as the filmmaker who's there on right there behind the camera when he's telling you that and owning up to it, it's heartbreaking, and it's sad, and it's kind of a tragedy in a way, because you just want to say, and many times, like, throughout this process of, like, the movie premiering at Sundance and all of the premieres that we've done and the response, like, I realized that I've, you know, come into this music means so much to so many people, and their friendship,
right,
means so much to so many people. And it's just like, you wish that you could just say, guys, like, you know, can you just put aside and figure it out, just because your friendship is going to do so much good for other people and other friendships. I mean, you could, especially this year, like, with the political season coming about, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash singing together at a political function could really help
the
help
world
things.
Right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's totally true. As a filmmaker, as the filmmaker of this movie, you know, did you approach Nash? Did you approach Neil Young? Did you approach Stephen Stills? Did you approach, I think you had Roger McGuinn in your stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think McGuinn is, like, the most easygoing Crosby hater, because he has the longest time apart, I think. It's not so fresh for McGuinn.
You got it. That's exactly it. With McGuinn and Chris Hillman, too, it was like, it's not, the wound is definitely healed over and the scar is barely there. But with Nash and, you know, his, you know, most recent, you know, breakups, it's still very tender. And so when we, you know, Cameron Crowe and I were first kind of got together, and I started telling him about what my ideas are, and we were bouncing back and forth on these ideas, but we both collectively decided that we didn't want to do a big parade of talking heads.
Right.
And with the way that Crosby tells stories and how great of a raconteur he is, you know, let the man tell his own story and describe his own journey for good and for bad. And you know, he like be the narrator of his own life story, like writing a long lost letter to an old friend or something. And so, you know, yeah, we did, you know, we were in communication with Graham and Steven, because, you know, when you do a movie, you have to get permission for, right, you know, for music. And so one wonderful thing, I think Graham Nash is just, he's a great guy. He is a very intellectual and smart person too. And he said he wasn't going to stand in the way of our movie. And he said that just make sure it's honest. And I think we did our best with that.
Yeah, it's really, really, really amazing. I mean, I'm a drug addict in recovery, and one thing, and our audience, like a ton of our audience, is either on drugs or in recovery, somewhere in between. And you want recovery to bring back your relationships. You want recovery to give you the nice bow at the end of your fucking fuck-ups. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, but I'm okay now. And I think this movie shows that sometimes the consequences of your actions make it impossible to get where where recompense is possible. But still, the future is unwritten for these guys. They've been friends, you know, for 40 years. So, like, as an optimist, you know, I have faith. Are you okay? You want to get a drink of water or something?
I'm good.
That
I'm
happens
good.
To Thank me you. In the worst moments. I fucking hate that.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's no problem. Now, I, from what I understood, because I heard Crosby on the Howard Stern show, and he was amazing. It was years ago, but he was amazing on Stern. And he said he's done with drugs, but he still smokes weed occasionally. Is he still smoking butt, or is he not smoking butt anymore?
Well, yeah, he does. He does smoke bud, you know, he. I don't really see that as. I see that as his pain relief, because he had a motorcycle accident and he screwed his shoulder up pretty bad, and you know, he's also got some major health issues, as discussed in the movie.
Right.
Like, he's got 9 stents in his heart. He's got. You know, he's had 2 or 3 heart attacks, and he's got, you know, he's had the liver transplant. And so the smoking pot is just kind of his medicinal pain relief. And he openly talks about in other interviews that are out there about how, for him, you know, he smoking bud during the day, he doesn't get anything done. And he's someone who has kind of an ambition to try to write, and, you know, he's got things he wants to accomplish during his day. And so, my experience around him is that he just smokes it at night and he uses it to sleep.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I can't judge anybody for anything. How much do you think, and this is a question that might offend you, so brace yourself. I don't want to offend you. How much does Neil Young hate him? Is there any way Neil Young will open up his heart to good old Kroz, or no?
Well, I don't really, I can't comment on, I think Neil's has commented about the movie in an LA Times article.
What did he say?
And I think he said something about, Crosby should write a book on, you know, how to lose friends or something like that. And you know, the issue is that Crosby made a comment about who is now Neil's wife, and the comment was made kind of in passing. He apologized for it. He a number of times, but Neil is that type of personality where, you know, it's happened many times where, like, in the middle of a tour or something like that, Neil will just decide that it's not right and he'll just, he's out. And
right.
He's a very stubborn, loyal person.
It's the, the mercurial nature of genius, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
And, you know, they're very, you know, it's again, that's one of those friendships that could be so beneficial if they could just work through it.
Well, the fucked up thing about that to me is, like, Crosby's going to fucking die. You know, he's on so is Neil Young. They're old men. They're on limited time frames. And as fans, you want to see them get together. I think the other thing in the movie, I mean, I think that, you know, the raw honesty blew my mind. But the thing that I had never seen before was the footage of them singing at the White House that Silent Night or Amazing Grace. Yeah. It was Silent Night.
Silent Night.
And it was like, I've never seen, I mean, like the harmony was so off and it was so like, it was just the closing of their band. And it was like so poignant and amazing to see what it, what, how did you find it? Did he bring it up? Did you know about it?
Well, we had done, you know, a series of interviews with Crosby on the road and throughout the course over about a year of like hardcore interviews, you know, but then I was, you know, also, you know, I would pop in at places on his tour and shoot footage but during the course of one of those, interviews, Cameron was there and he asked him about, you know, when was the last time you guys played together? And he went on to describe that whole, experience, you know, singing at the White House. And, you know, unfortunately it's that they, sometimes life, kind of encounters things and you have an experience that are symbolic of what you're feeling. You know, that was not only that it was cold outside and all that, but there were some technical problems too that were making those, you know, giving the wrong board feeds to the wrong, you know, in-ear monitors. Uh-huh. And so it wasn't like, it's not that they come off that terrible when they were actually singing, but there were some technical problems, but it was very symbolic of what was happening in real life, that they were out of harmony. They were not working together and things were just not working. And it is kind of ironic that the last, so yes, finding that footage it was out there and we, you know, it was part of the historical, public record, being that it was an official Park Service or official White House, you know, event or through the Park Service or the, yeah.
Totally. And Stephen Stills can't sing anymore anyway, though, right? He can barely sing now, right?
Well, he's just been playing in loud bands for a long time. So it's hard. He's, you know, hearing is an issue.
Well, his style also was more guttural, you know what I mean, than Crosby and Nash. And it's harder to sustain that kind of a voice, I think. I loved your movie, man, and I really, really appreciate you coming on our little show. And, you know, when I started making the show with my friend who's a drug addict also, and he wound up relapsing and dying years ago. And
sorry to hear that,
yeah, man. It's terrible. But Crosby was always, you know, I have a list of people that I've always wanted to be on the show, and Crosby has always been right at the top of the list. And when he blocked me from Twitter, my heart broke into 1,000 pieces, although I was impressed that David Crosby spent the minute to block me. I felt like very important for a second. So please tell him that we love him in the Dopey Nation and that his story could help people if he wanted to come on, you know, because you could tell him.
I'll tell him.
All right.
I'll tell him.
And more importantly, you know, though, thank him for the music and thank you for the movie. It was so tremendous. It's such a good movie. What's coming up from you?
Well, thank you. I'm really honored that you respond to the movie, and it means that means it's just a real honor for me to hear that from you guys. And you know, what was kind of cool just about the addiction part is that I knew that it was going to be a very sensitive topic, and you know, a lot of people, the first thing that they want to do is ask Crosby about, oh, because that's the thing. One of the things that he's known for is being the guy who got thrown into jail, you know, doing drugs. And I was, when I first met him, I was really just not really interested in going to that typical place, or that place that a lot of other, you know, tabloid media interviews, everything, they always want to ask him. And it was his, after we generated a level of trust, because, and it came through the music, and the music that he was writing today, as I say, it's like the window is open and the light shining through. The lyrics in some of these new albums, Lighthouse and Here If You Listen especially, are talking about these days of, like, Christine, you know, his losing his girlfriend, and how he's still kind of processing those experiences, and kind of, you know, he's, the clouds have parted, and he's really wanting to talk about it. So he went there. You know, he was once we really started talking, he was openly willing to start talking about those things that are hard. And the same thing goes with Jan Crosby too.
Well, I want to mention this before, because I ended it prematurely without talking about addiction. That's how terrible I am at making my show. But the thing that you're talking about is that Crosby was a crazy acid head, you know, pot smoker, drug taker, but he had this beautiful girlfriend who died tragically in a car accident, which was the trauma that really drove him to the insane levels of drug use, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, who's to say what would have happened had she not died like that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that was his, there's, I think, a great line in the movie. He said that, you know, you take drugs to make it try to feel better, but then you feel bad about taking drugs, and so you take more drugs, and it just turns into this, like, vicious, like, downward spiral. And but, you know, he's been in the program, you know, a number of programs, and he's really good at talking about owning up and taking responsibility, and he is in a good place where I think he's been very helpful to a lot of people who've also suffered. And then, of course, you see the relationship between he and Jan, where she was someone who was trying to pull him out. And she says, well, here, why don't I take some to see how it goes so I can help pull you out?
And she became a crippled drug addict, crackhead, heroin addict, yeah. Right? Like, she had it. Yeah. And the two of them look so much better now. And he actually, that story with what's-her-face, with Melissa Etheridge, that he was the sperm donor, right, for her baby.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's a rich life right there. You know what I'm saying?
Sure is.
You do all this stuff, and then the fact that he's touring, leaving him, you know, leaving Jan, leaving his house, leaving his world, why is he doing it, really? Because he loves to perform.
Well, I think it's two things. I think, yes, if you will, I think his drug is the audience adulation.
Right.
I think his drug is getting up there and being able to play music and hearing that roar of an audience. And I think that's a real healthy, great drug, you know. And so he's forever going to be doing that. And he loves making music. And I think that if he were to, you know, retire or something, which is not really plausible for the Crosby that I know, you know, sitting back and, you know, on a rocking chair, that would be, the music is what's keeping him going.
Right. And perhaps if he didn't tour, I mean, like, I know that I don't relapse by staying busy. I don't consider using by staying as engaged as I can possibly be. And I'm sure that's similar for him, even though I've never had the honor of actually meeting him. I mean, busyness is the great remedy for a lot of addicts. It's feeling useful. It's knowing who you are and what you're supposed to be doing. What's the reaction from the fans? Like, when you took Crosby to the Topanga Canyon market, was there a reaction? Because it looks like nobody's there. Did people see him?
Laurel Canyon?
Yeah, sorry, Laurel Canyon Market, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, that was a real fun day because – we had done a number of interviews with Crosby, and he had talked about these various stages of his life a number of times throughout this series. And I finally said, look, we've got to go with Crosby into the world and go and get some reactions from him and figure out, you know, how he's going to respond, because it's easy to sit in a chair and contemplate, until, you know, these stories about and reminisce. But if you go and sit on the steps of the place that it happens, you're going to have a different set of reactions, and you're going to be flooded with memories. And that's what you want to do. So anyway, he was literally on his way to tour, and he lives, you know, north of Santa Barbara, as you see in the movie. It takes a couple of hours to drive to L.A., and it's, so, you know, getting him going to Laurel Canyon we needed to go before he had to go and do a rehearsal and some press and start going out on tour. So he reluctantly wasn't too happy about going to Laurel Canyon because he, as you can see, he just doesn't think that it's gotten overblown and too cliche. And a lot of people like think that it was like this romantic thing. And as you see in the movie, he's like, there's no cinematic value here at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's not the shot. It's not here.
Yeah.
but he ends up going right after he says that, then he ends up talking about his memories with Cass and his memories with Joni, and we pull up to the house at Joni, and he, you know, and that was exactly what I was hoping.
That was your plan. It all paid off. Your diabolical plan came to fruition, which was,
that's right. That's right. And he, to his commendable credit, like he was willing to go because he trusted us, and he was willing to talk about those things that were he'd rather not talk about, or he's been asked about dozens of times, but this was the chance to do it right, you know.
Well, that's the strength of the movie. The strength of the movie is the vulnerability and the fact that Crosby fucked up and didn't fix everything and can own up to his failures, his weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what makes the movie so great. I was reading an interview where he's talking about music docs that aren't so fulfilling, and he kind of acknowledges the Keith Richards doc as this, it was a good documentary, but it doesn't show the pain of failure, of defeat, of the hero who fails and then just gets up again, and the value in that, you know, that's the strength of this movie, which is why it really just blew me away.
Thank you. Yeah.
So
I had encouraged Crosby to watch the Keith Richards doc. I also took him to see a movie called Keep On Keeping On, which is about this legendary jazz flugelhorn musician named Clark Terry.
Yeah, sure.
And Clark was known as a mentor to many musician and jazz musician, and his first student was Quincy Jones.
Right.
But it was it's a real tender, great story of a musician, and I could see Crosby was responding to those movies, both the Keith Richards and the Keep On Keeping On, and I could see that I was showing him like I think we could be honest, and I think we can make a beautiful story. And by the way, you've got some beautiful new music too, and that's the whole movie closes with this song that just absolutely melts your heart called Glory, which is just like, through it all, the guy is still coming up with these great melodies and working with these young people, and it's kind of rebirth.
Yeah, amazing. I love that. One more thing is, how are the people reacting to him? You know what I mean? Like when you travel with Crosby, like what does the man in the street say to him?
Oh, well, you know, he's an interesting guy because he's a celebrity and he's a well-known person, but also some people, younger folk, they know that they know him, but they don't know what exactly they know him from.
Right.
So he even finds some. There's a funny story that I have him telling, which is like he was in New Orleans and he was walking into his hotel and this person spots him and there's like, oh my God, Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
You're Simon and Garfunkel. He goes, no, not Simon and Garfunkel. No, yes, you are. Everyone, look, it's Simon and Garfunkel. So people know that he's a famous musician, but sometimes they think that, and so because he's of that era. But you know, a lot of people, the typical thing is that people want to come up and share with him that, you know, oh, you know, Deja Vu, I had that album, or went to Woodstock, or what was it like at Woodstock, and he's pretty good at dealing with people, but he's also, you know, he's kind of tired of being asked that same question about Woodstock over and over again. But, you know, that's part of his journey, is that you're a celebrity and you got, you know, you were part of something that changed the world, and people are going to ask you a lot about it. And but for me, being on tour with the movie, premiering at Sundance, and I get people come up to me and if it's almost as if like I did a Star Wars movie. If you forgive me for saying that, if I may be so bold, but it's
you
like,
mean one of the good Star Wars movies, though?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Where it's like you're taking on something that means so much to so many people, mm-hmm. and you have the major responsibility of treating it with reverence and dignity
and intelligence and in depth
and intelligence. Yeah, and depth, and you know, people are going to go see it, but you know, treat it. You know, you've got a major responsibility, and so I knew that going in, but also objective too. You know, so I knew that we couldn't. Sometimes, like, there's going to be the typical things that you would expect, the typical songs, and so we went with some deep cuts instead. You know, like. We know that the birds did turn. We've seen that in so many movies. Every movie that has to describe the, you know, the 60s or 70s, they'll often use that song. And so we thought, let's do, you know, so you want to be a rock and roll star. And that's symbolic of what these guys were doing at the time.
Totally. Well, that's the thing.
And many other things.
When you talk about being like handling a Star Wars movie, I mean, like I spent like 5 years of my life watching Woodstock over and over again, watching all this footage. So when you're entrusted to these incredible scenes, you know, the birds live at the Whiskey and Woodstock and Crosby, Stills and Nash on tour, it is that. I mean, you're inscribed like this ridiculous world of rock and roll value, and then mm-hmm. you get to use it as you see fit to make his story have the kind of gravitas that it's meant to have, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you did a good job, man. I hope you're proud of yourself, because I'm proud of you.
Well, I'm honored to have been entrusted with that responsibility, and I'm honored to have been, you know, had the opportunity to work with like one of my director heroes, Cameron Crowe, and. You know, Michelle Farinola and my whole team of people, because, you know, I learned early on, having worked with a number of directors, is that the best thing you do is it's like putting a band together. You hire the best players that you possibly can.
Totally.
And we had the dream team. But, you know, I was going to tell you, like, I had so many people, you know, during the premieres and, you know, the screenings of this movie would come up to me afterward and they would be crying. And that was very impactful to me because I just didn't know how to handle this onslaught of emotion. And I remember one woman coming up to me at Sundance just bawling. And she was like, I just want to thank you because that was the first album that I bought. And it was the only album that my dad and I could listen to together. And it's still to this day, it was the only way that we could talk, you know, so
wow.
You can see that this music means so much to people in so many ways. And I remember watching her, like, walk in her high heels through the snow, just crying. And just, I'll never forget that. And that happened so many times where I would have that happen and I would need to go and take a walk myself just to kind of clear my head and realize, like, because when you're making a movie and you're being, you know, telling someone's story, like we did, and you know, when you've got Crosby and Jan Crosby admitting these things that are so hard, but your head is just down to the grindstone, you know, and then you see it with an audience, you realize, like, oh my God, like it really can. So I it was very emotionally impactful for me to experience that.
Well, I think it's awesome, and I thank you for coming on. And if you're looking for a project, maybe you should consider doing the Dopey movie. Maybe that should be coming up. Look into
maybe,
it.
Yeah.
It's got a lot more depth than you might think. Maybe one day.
We'll talk.
AJ Eaton, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
So that was AJ Eaton, a true mensch, as we like to say. Amazing filmmaker, good guy. And I'm sure you guys are wondering, did we ever have talks about the Dopey documentary in the works? Let's just say there have been a few suitors for the Dopey doc, but let's say it's not happening just yet. One day there will be a glorious documentary about Dopey. I don't know when that will be, but it will be eventually. So I don't know if you guys remember this, but one of my favorite sponsors ever was Brainwash Coffee, because they give half of their profits to addicts, which I love. And we have a little Brainwashed coffee competition. And I have a voicemail from there that I want to play for you guys. It's fucking a great running from the law story from one of our wonderful listeners from down south. His name is Adam. Check it out.
What's up, Dave? Dopey Nation. That's Adam from Alabama checking in with a little dopey story for the brainwashed coffee. So I was 18. I had just gotten out of my first rehab. I went to my first rehab when I was like 17. Spent a year. Actually, I only stayed for 6 months. Anyways, I get back out on the streets and pretty much immediately started getting high again. I had already been shooting coke, but then I got introduced to shooting methamphetamines, which I had been doing meth forever and just had never shot it. So me and this guy that I'd met in rehab, we meet up on the streets and we start making counterfeit money. And we decide that we'll go buy an off-road vehicle with it. So like a Jeep. So we go and we buy a Jeep and everything goes smooth. We get the Jeep and we go to this motel on the other side of town and we're in the motel and I'm in there printing money and he goes outside and he's like spray painting the Jeep black and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And we, this Indian guy comes down there and he's like, you must leave, and talks about calling the cops. So we pack everything up real quick and we get out of there and we go driving and we try to find another hotel. And when we pull in, there's a bunch of SUVs. And if you're tweaked out, SUVs automatically mean task force. So I'm like, man, I think the task force is here. We need to leave. So we go to leave. And as we're pulling out, this truck is like on the road and he doesn't have a stop sign, but yet he still stops and tells us to go in front of him. So we pull out, and as we pull out, I look in the dash or in the grill and I see little lights and I'm like, man, that's the fucking cops. And I tell him to get on the interstate and try to get us over the state line because we weren't far from the state line. Well, like that was even going to do anything. Like they're just going to stop at the state line. Yeah, right. So anyways, we take off down the interstate and then the cop hits his lights. That truck followed us. He hits his lights. Sure enough, it's a cop. We're in a chase. Dude driving's like, I'm not stopping. And we're going as fast as this little Jeep will take us. And we get to this exit and he like goes off the side of the interstate and up this hill and comes out on the road and we're going down this road. It's a curvy road and he's on the wrong side of the road and on turns. And I just know we're about to die or go to prison for the rest of our life. We got a whole line of cops behind us. And then we come around a turn and in the straightaway, there's a cop and he lets out a spike strip. And man, I felt like I was on Cops or some shit. Anyways, we get away from him. We go down, he swerves. He says he missed the spike strip. We're still running. We cut down this ditch and go down this road. And we wreck into a cow gate and then into a tree. And then we had a dog. And, I couldn't get out because my door was pinned shut. So I had to bail out the other side of the Jeep. And we're running and running. And anyways, we got away. And it obviously scared me to death. We didn't get away together, though. We separated. And I went back to my grandmother's house and was like, I'm done with this shit. And, that didn't last long. It's a little bit longer of a story, but I'm already a minute over, so fuck it. There it is. I hope I get some coffee. Talk to you guys later. Stay strong, Dopey Nation. Fucking toodles for Chris.
So thank you, Adam. Killer voicemail. I love running from the law stories. It always makes me think of the Blues Brothers. If you guys out there have a good dopey story where something ridiculous happened and you want to win some coffee, I think I'm going to honor the Brainwash Coffee Company's dopey story shit. I'm going to send Adam, or the Brainwash Coffee Company is going to send Adam some coffee. Check them out at brainwashcoffeeco.com. Send in emails and voicemails to dopeypodcast@gmail.com. It is a joy to put out this show. It is a joy to be in recovery and reflect on the side-splitting and, you know, heart-wrenching antics that got us all here. AJ Eden is a, you know, amazing documentarian. David Crosby, of course, is one of us. We're just chugging along over here. So thank you guys for being a part of the Dopey Nation. I hope you enjoyed the show. Stay strong, my brothers and sisters in and out of recovery. And fucking toodles for Chris.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Money in my pocket, then I guess I'll just have to walk around my neighborhood.